Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Giulia Galef. Giulia, what's our topic today?
Well, Massimo, today is a very special episode because it's our one-year anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary!
Did you get me anything?
No, sorry. Oh. next year.
It would have been so easy. The official one-year anniversary gift is paper, so that really, really would have been so easy for you. You're in the doghouse now.
Yep.
Oh, well. Interestingly, today is also another special holiday. It's Perihelinox, which if our listeners haven't heard of it, that's because our producer Benny made it up. It's the day that the Earth is closest to the sun. So we decided
make that one up, but it made that into a holiday.
Right, exactly. Right. He's on a personal quest to get this holiday wider renown.
And I'm told that there is exactly one Google hit on the word for now. So that's...
Is it from our teaser?
I believe it is.
All right, then. So he's got his work cut out for him. Yep. Anyway, so we were going to take advantage of this double anniversary today to talk about anniversaries and about holidays in general, whether they're arbitrary or not, and what significance they have, what role they've played in history and culture. And joining us to help explore that question is a special guest, Professor Timothy Alborn. Timothy earned his PhD in history of science from Harvard and taught history of social studies at Harvard for 8 years, then joined the City of University of New York in 1999 and became chair of the Department of History at Lehman College, where he's now the Dean of Arts and Humanities. He specializes in British history, in particular in the intersection between big business and culture in the 19th century. And he's published the book Conceiving Companies, Joint Stock Politics in Victorian England in 1998, and Regulated Lives, Life Insurance in British Society, 1800 to 1914. And that came out in 2009. And he also happens to be Massimo's boss.
That's right. I'm sure that
so I'm particularly intrigued to meet him.
That's on his CV because it must be very difficult to do.
Anyway, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So what's a historian's perspective on anniversaries then?
Well, I thought I'd start by talking about the way I first confronted such things, which is I do the history of business. And one of the main sources I use reading about business are histories of companies, which almost always are published as centenaries or bicentenaries or whatever the 150 or 50 are called. The one book I found that talks about company histories has referred to them as, quote, one of the most unread of all history books.
and that must be a record.
Literary fiascos, corporate white elephants, and so on and so forth. But there are many, many, many of them. Germany is especially popular. 500 company histories a year are published in Germany. BASF published its centenary in 1984, 313,000 copies, most of which were given to its employees as a way to uphold company spirit. Interestingly, this also is a great example of the laws of supply and demand not working. I looked it up on Amazon, and the cheapest copy you can get used is $77 for a paperback.
Wow.
proving, I think, again, the great unread theory. And as I looked into the way companies established their own identity and their own longevity in this way, I also started noticing, as the companies I studied, when the centenary came along and centennial or whatever, they would also celebrate it by giving extra dividends to their shareholders, by giving bonuses to their workers, and all the rest. So it really ended up being a ritual in the social life of the business. But then, as I kind of step back as a historian, I also noticed that anniversaries are, really part and parcel of what we do as historians. They are tremendous opportunities for us to get people to pay attention to our corner of the world. As long as we're fortunate to be around when our corner of the world happens to have an important year.
What would be some example of
Well, that? The best example I came up with, I did a little research on this afternoon, is the French Revolution.
Ah.
1989, and I very unscientifically looked up how many hits different events got in titles of books in WorldCat, which is a catalog essentially collecting all English, all books held in English language libraries, America and England. The French Revolution in 1987 had 144 hits. In 1988 had 296 hits. In 1989 had 7,082 hits.
Wow. So that's several orders of magnitude more.
Yeah, and then it kept going because the French Revolution kept going. So it had 2,000 hits in 1991, 5,700 in 1992, 5,700 in 1993, and then back down to 200 in 1994 thereafter.
So there's a coda effect, and then it tapers off.
Well, because the French Revolution did continue, so historians could continue to milk it for another 4 years. In contrast, the American Revolution only had 700-some hits in 1974, went up to 1,200 in 1976, and then right back down. Hmm. And these are, you know, these are libraries in America and England. These are, you know, these are not French libraries. And
right, so I would think that
I have no idea why that's the case, why the French Revolution ends up being, maybe it's inversely proportioned to how many people pay attention to the French Revolution. So the French Revolution historians kind of jump on this opportunity and all circle around it, whereas the Americans, you know, they write about the American Revolution all the time because people will always buy books about that.
I'm
not sure.
That could be. That might be an interesting explanation for it. Well, I was noticing, for instance, you know, last year, as you know, actually at this point 2 years ago, 2009 was the 150th anniversary of the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species.
Yeah.
And accordingly, as you might imagine, a lot of scientists and science historians and philosophers of science wrote about Darwin. In fact, by the end of the year, frankly, I couldn't hear the word Darwin without having some kind of allergic reaction. But it was also interesting to me what was not celebrated. As it turns out, for instance, it was also the 200th anniversary of the publication of Lamarck, seminal book.
Absolutely.
And which arguably you might actually argue, you know, started the whole evolution thing to begin with. Yes, he had the wrong theory, but nonetheless, it historically was very important. In a different field, but also 150th anniversary, it was the 150th of John Stuart Mill on Liberty. And I saw maybe one article in the New York Times about it at some point during the year, which struck me as bizarre considering that On Liberty is foundational to the structure of modern democracy, which one might argue is actually more important to most people's lives than Darwin's discoveries, as important as they were scientifically. So it's kind of interesting to me. I have no idea why it is that Darwin got so much attention across the Western world, at least. I don't know outside of it. And things like John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, and a little less surprising, I guess, Lamarck did absolutely nothing of the sort. I'm wondering if it is a reflection of sort of the psychology of the profession.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I thought about that a little because you were talking about it in a previous conversation with me, and I think it has something to do with the way historians of science market their work and market themselves. It's very much a great man discipline. And I think, I mean, there is also a well-oiled Darwin industry, yes. so-called primarily because it is a colossal project to collect everything Darwin ever wrote, every letter he ever signed. And that industry was, you know, essentially coming close to its culmination by the end of the last decade. So in other words, everything was primed to have all this material ready to go. And while it wasn't kind of predetermined, it wasn't kind of calculated 20 years ago to start collecting everything Darwin ever wrote so that by 150 years after The Origin of Species, it would all be ready. I think it was a convenient coincidence. That this was you know, this was just available, this vast amount of material, of information. I mean, there are 30 or 40 people in Cambridge, England, who have spent their last 25 years of their professional lives collecting information about Darwin, you know, in a sense for this moment.
Which right there, it's an interesting statistic. Before we leave Darwin, I have another little comment to make about this. So For the 100th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species in 1959, that was a big one because it was 100. Yeah. But it happened to coincide with the sort of solidification within the field of a significant set of advances in evolutionary biology. Right. So there was a famous conference that was held at the University of Chicago, and the proceedings from that conference are still today considered a classic in the field, because almost everybody was a who's who in evolutionary biology at the time, which was, of course, a much smaller field to begin with, was there. And so the proceedings recorded not just the presentations at the meetings, but also even the discussion, transcriptions of the discussions and so on and so forth. And so it happened that that particular anniversary coincided with a fairly big moment in the history of the field.
And that book is still taught in history of science courses today.
Right. Now, as a consequence, of course, knowing that experience, several people tried to repeat this for the 150th anniversary. So several conferences were organized with pretty much the same idea of sort of, let's see where the field is at this point. And the University of Chicago Press, for instance, published, or it's supposed to publish, the proceedings of one of these. But of course, it didn't work this time, because although evolutionary biology has in fact been going arguably through just as much change over the last 50 years than it had been by the time of the first 100 years, they have not congealed, they have not actually solidified into something that everybody or most people in the community agree on. There's a lot of disagreements about where exactly certain areas of evolutionary biology are going. So we're going to have all of these records, printed records, of how much disagreement actually there is in the field at the moment. And I mean, I suppose from the point of view of historians of science, that's just as interesting, if not more possibly, than the previous one. But it was interesting to me that the contrast, it just didn't work the second time around, because the field, of course, doesn't respect the arbitrary anniversary.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, that's it leads to the question of it might be just as useful to direct everyone's attention to one thing at a point where there isn't it isn't the right time for agreement.
If you know what I mean. It's a good time. It's a good time to explore something that perhaps has not been there's not been much focus on precisely
what you're basically saying is that a huge number of questions are being generated as a result of these conferences and so forth. And you know, whenever you get people together for a conference, it doesn't really matter the excuse. If they're smart people, they're going to come up with interesting questions and interesting ideas. I went to a conference 1992 to celebrate the bicentenary of the birth of a fairly obscure philosopher named William Whewell.
Yes, I know of him.
Yeah, I would think that you would. And there was really no point. And I mean, it was at Trinity College where he was master and so forth, but it was just a very good conference because there were a lot of smart people who had come across him in their lives. And we all got together and had a lot to drink and talked about William Whewell for 3 days. And
you know, I didn't know about Whewell until fairly recently. And it turns out that he has a couple of interesting reasons why he should be remembered. First of all, he actually got involved in a debate with Darwin, as a matter of fact, about the role of induction in science. And he thought that Darwin wasn't doing science because he wasn't using the inductive method.
Right.
And Darwin was very upset by this whole thing, because on the other hand, he thought that what he was doing was exactly what Whewell was suggesting one should do. So that led to an interesting discussion.
Well, Whewell was something of a Platonist, and so, which Darwin's was not.
No,
so,
that's right.
I mean, Whewell's idea of the inductive method was rather odd from the point of view of people who identify that with empiricism.
Right. But the other reason I think Whewell should be remembered is because he actually coined, from what I understand, the term scientist.
Yes.
The term scientist was not in use until the early to middle part of the 19th century, and it was coined by Whewell in analogy with artist.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's interesting for the science-inclined listener among
to that. And that whole episode accompanied the formation of the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1832, which, you know, we're coming. And I think, you know, it was very much in Britain, you know, of the time, a moment when science was moving from being an amateur to a so-called professional occupation, which didn't really mean anything because these were still mostly gentlemen and propertied individual like Darwin was, but in terms of the way they looked at their discipline. And I think that in turn helps to account for the proliferation of anniversaries. Mm-hmm. In the sciences in particular, that accompanies, for instance, the increasing amount of use of eponymy.
Yeah.
So there's Gauss's law, and there's this law, and that law, and the other law. Well, whenever someone has a scientific law named after them, you can be rest assured that when some sort of centenary or whatever comes along, people are going to maybe sit down and have a conference or something, because the practicing scientists as well as the historians use that person's name in their daily work.
Right.
So it sounds like you were implying earlier that there isn't necessarily that much of a correlation between how important an event was in our history or was to people and how big of a deal its anniversary is. Have you noticed any other factors that influence what anniversaries become big deals?
Well, there's not a necessary correlation. I mean, there's obviously, it's very rare that you're going to get people to buy a lot of books about something that no one's ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting that I think it's partly a question of how well-developed the marketing machine is among the historians or those who have some sort of investment in the event. And as I suggest with the American Revolution example, it might also have something to do with how pervasive people's interests in the event is. Consequently, we might not need to be reminded of it. That was actually kind of surprising to me that the American Revolution had so many fewer hits than the French Revolution. But I think it also has something to do with how current or how relevant it seems to remember an event. So I would be very interested to see what the play is for the centenary of the Russian Revolution in 5 years or 7 years, right?
Right.
Professional historians obviously will be interested in it, but will it have this explosion of popular books that the French Revolution had? And why did the French Revolution have that explosion? I think it was along the lines of what you were saying about Darwin in 1959, the field of French history at that point in time was right in the middle of everyone was rethinking the French Revolution. And so everyone had a lot to say about it at that point in time. They might not have had as much to say about it if the bicentennial had been 10 years earlier or later.
So you were pointing to me before the podcast about the fact that some of these celebrations can actually become rather odd, particularly from a political perspective. You're thinking about the 1992 celebration of the 500 anniversary of what exactly?
Well, exactly. Christopher Columbus, quote unquote, discovered America in 1992. There were movies. Honest to God, quincentennial celebrations with people going on parades. A lot of Italians, in particular, were quite pleased about this event. On the other hand, there was a significant, if not majority, of events were quite, in the contrary, remembering it as genocide, remembering it as the beginning of the end for the native populations of the New World. And it created very interesting kind of what we would call in academia the teaching moments.
Mm-hmm.
My wife teaches Western Civ, and the availability of teaching materials on the conquest skyrocketed in 1992, whether you're talking about films or whether you're talking about textbooks or scholarly articles, all of a sudden, and this is because it happened to be 500 years later, at a time when multiculturalism was firmly entrenched in academia, all of a sudden you had all sorts of resources at your disposal for how to talk about 1492 in a much, much more complicated way than people would have talked about it 20 years earlier. And they were already doing that in academia, but just in terms of the amount of material that was generated to allow historians and teachers from grade school on up, really, to start thinking critically about that event, I think had everything to do with 1992.
And do you feel like governments tend to try to control the way that these anniversary discussions go? I mean, since Well, they can be either commemorations or opportunities for criticism.
I mean, 1492 is very complicated because there's no one government who's in, you know, who would want to take or need to take credit for that. For national centennials and bicentennials, absolutely. I mean, this would be it's a no-brainer for a government not to try to turn this into a propaganda opportunity. You know, we were all around in 1976 with the bicentennial, and it was I was only, you know, I was 12 years old, but I could see what was going on around me in terms of
NASA managed to land the Vikings on Mars precisely for the anniversary in July 1976.
Exactly.
So that was a big deal.
So yeah, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. On the other hand, I think centennial and bicentennial celebrations are opportunities for subversion as well. Precisely because everyone is supposed to be celebrating it, it's available for people to define why it's an important event from any number of perspectives.
And of course, we talk about politics. We cannot talk about anniversaries without talking about religion. And particularly, we're taping this episode, of course, around the beginning of a new year. So we just went through the usual standard around Christmas celebrations. And it's to me that the whole Christmas thing is, in fact, very interesting, particularly the way it's often presented as, you know, remember what is the real reason for the season. Well, really, what was the real reason for the season? Because the history is pretty complicated there, right? I mean, we know, for instance, that there's nothing in the Gospels that tells us anything about the birth date of Jesus. So
right.
December 25th is certainly, at the very least, arbitrary. But in fact, we know better than that. Historians are pretty clear on the fact that it's not arbitrary. It was a decision made, actually I have the particular date and Pope who made that decision. It was made by Pope Liberius, who declared December 25th, the birth of Jesus, in the year 354. So this was a few hundred years after the fact. And the reason he did it is because the Catholic Church had realized that they better take over the original celebration, the Saturnalia, that was celebrated by the Romans, as a, you know, obviously was a pagan celebration, but it was very popular.
Yeah,
probably
sure.
In part because it involved orgies and all sorts of bacchanals.
That never hurts.
That never hurts the celebration. And, of course, the Catholic Church first tried to stop it, and then when they realized that they couldn't, they simply took it over, which is actually a fairly standard way for a new culture, a new religion to deal
with. Easter unfolds in a similar fashion.
Right, exactly. Easter is a similar idea. Now, we mentioned earlier, actually, during the pick for another podcast, that, however, a lot of people still today, even in the secular humanist community, tend to be confused about exactly what the relationship is between December 25th and, for instance, the Saturnalia. It turns out that the Saturnalia was celebrated from the 17th through the 24th of of December. And so the 25th was actually a different occasion for the Romans. It was the birth of the sun. And since the Sol Invictus, the invincible sun, was the symbol of the Roman legions, so the sun was obviously an important, the god Apollo was an important celebrity, divinity for Romans. So the 25th was supposed to be his birthday, and that's how we get, of course, a direct superposition with
And you've got a little star on top of the Christmas tree.
Exactly. And it all fits very nicely at this point. But we have more recent examples of the same thing. So, for instance, the Cuenza celebration.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a taking over or associating with a pre-existing holiday. It's not really a takeover, but it's association with a previous holiday for entirely arbitrary reasons, other than, you know, the only reason is because there is, in fact, an holiday that has already been celebrated. When I looked it up, the basic history of Kwanzaa, you know, it is celebrated from December 26th to January 1st, so I guess technically they skipped the 25th, but they start the day after, so it's not that far. It was created by Maulana Karenga and was first celebrated in 1966. And the original idea was, and I quote, to give blacks an alternative to the existing holiday and give blacks an opportunity to celebrate themselves and history rather than simply imitate the practice of the dominant society. The word Kwanzaa derives from a Swahili phrase, which means first fruits of the harvest. But the interesting thing, perhaps very few people actually realize today, is that the originator, Mr. Karenga, had some very strong ideas about Christmas. He said that that the Kwanzaa was meant as an alternative to Christmas because Jesus was psychotic and Christianity was a white religion that black people should shun. And then apparently it worked for a little while. I mean, we're talking about the 60s and the 70s, so the apex of black power.
Yeah.
And then statistically, Kwanzaa is now essentially leveled off. I think it's the statistics are that it's celebrated by 1.6% of Americans or something like that. So it's a fairly low thing. And presumably because we live in now in a post-black liberation time.
Yeah, and you know, it's actually... To the extent that Kwanzaa is a celebration of an anniversary of the Black Power movement, it would be interesting to kind of track that alongside other. I'm just thinking about this out loud, but there are these epochal moments in the civil rights movement. There aren't really epochal moments in the Black Power movement. They don't have an opportunity to kind of identify dates to say this is when this happened, as opposed to the I Have a Dream speech or something like that. And, you know, we see that on TV. Every anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, we see Martin Luther King on TV. We don't really have that equivalent in Black Power in America. So I wonder if in some subliminal fashion Kwanzaa is kind of filling that role.
I actually think Kwanzaa is a good example of why it works better to adapt older holidays than create new ones, because from everything that I've read about Kwanzaa, it sounds like it is trying really hard to give this sense of traditions that have this long root in history. You do things like lighting candles and pouring water from earthen bowls into your hands and reciting
words. It's an invented tradition.
Right,
absolutely.
But I mean, it feels like, and I can see what they were going for. Those are the sorts of things that traditions of centuries and millennia ago have done, but it was all sort of created out of nothing in the 60s. And I think it's really hard to get that old antique
feeling.
When you create something out of nothing.
But it's fine. It's interesting, Tim, you say that, you know, in one case it's entirely artificial and sort of created with a conscious model in mind. Of course, all cultural traditions are, in some sense, artificial. But I guess the difference
is that really
right,
works
it's
the magic.
Age and probably to some extent that sort of the organicity of it, for lack of a better word. I mean, some celebrations, for instance, ancient celebrations of harvest. That's natural, as in, you know, there is a reason why people celebrate that particular moment during the year, and you can see that people probably did the obvious, eating and drinking and that sort of thing. It's very different if you actually consciously sit down and plan a thing and say, okay, well, I want to have a celebration, and, you know, what kind of elements do I bring together? That inevitably, it's not just that it's recent, it's that inevitably brings up a flavor of artificiality that the historical tradition doesn't have.
It's a little bit like saying, okay, guys, here's what our inside joke is going to be. It just doesn't stick. It has to arise organically.
Yeah. Well, the other issue is that, you know, the African American community in America is one of the most Christian communities in the country.
Right.
Oh, right.
So exactly what kind of alternative are we engaging in here? The more interesting comparison in many ways is Hanukkah, which is by all accounts not an extraordinarily important holiday in the Jewish religious calendar, yet it gets more and more and more play, and in effect is bought into by more and more Jews, entirely because of when it happens to be.
Right. The Jewish kids really hated the fact that their friends were getting presents at this time and they weren't.
As John Stewart often points out, that he doesn't get many presents because he wished to be Christian. He wished to be Christian when he was
young.
Which
gets us back to why people really celebrate Christmas in the first place.
That's right. The real reason for the season. That's right. It's the food and drinking, which goes back to the Saturnalia, of course.
Yeah. At Skepticon 3, Skeptic Humanist Conference in November, Rebecca Watson, the skeptic of skeptic fame, gave a really funny, really insightful lecture about, it was called How to Ruin Christmas. And she was talking about some of the complaints from Christians in the U.S. about the so-called war on Christmas that atheists and secularists are waging, trying to get crèches removed and removing any reference
that shows
of
up on
Merry
the Daily
Christmas,
Show
right?
Exactly.
It is a little farcical, but she made a really good point that if we really wanted to win the war on Christmas and sort of take the Christian meaning out of the holiday, we wouldn't do it by going on the offensive in such an explicit way. We would do it. Well, she made the analogy to Thanksgiving, which was originally, I believe, a had religious undertones. I mean, people were giving thanks to God.
Absolutely.
And now there's pretty much no religious connotation at all. In fact, I'd forgotten, it had just become one word in my mind. I forgot about that it was about giving thanks. Thanksgiving was just one word.
It depends on where you... On your upbringing, I think.
Oh, that may be true. I'm sure my perspective is a little biased on this.
There was plenty of praying on Thanksgiving where I grew up.
Oh, okay. Well, but at least when you look at the way it's portrayed in just decorations popular and popular culture, it's just completely a-religious. And I guess that happened because it just got adopted by the general culture and turned into sort of just a time to feel grateful for things and eat food and get together with family. And so that is already sort of happening with Christmas.
I mean, the analogy to the war on Christmas, I think, is clearly the war on marriage.
Mm-hmm.
With the gay marriage issue. It's the same thing. So, since when was marriage a Christian event?
Right.
It's a civil union. And so I think the same strategy is going on in that campaign, and that might be a good segue to wedding anniversaries.
That's right. So why do we celebrate anniversaries? I have to bring in the my pet peeve, which is since I moved to the United States, I cringe every time that I hear somebody using the word anniversary for something that is not a yearly thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear about the first
the month
anniversary or the 3 month anniversary.
Well,
so, and of course, in Latin, annus means year. And so it's something that rubs me the wrong way. But at any rate, a year, of course, it's an arbitrary period of time anyway. Yes, we do get this trip around the sun, obviously, that it's completed. But since it's an ellipse, it really doesn't matter where you start that trip.
I think you're splitting.
That's so romantic, Massimo.
It is very romantic, isn't it? But for instance, so, you know, next week I'm going to celebrate my birthday. And yes, it is arbitrary, but should I not celebrate it? Is there a rational reason not to celebrate it?
Well, I mean, if you start looking too hard at the rational reasons we do anything, that way madness lies, I think.
I would say it makes a lot more sense to celebrate a wedding anniversary than a birthday.
Because it's a choice as opposed to a...
Because it was a choice. I didn't choose to be born. I chose to get married. And I've been married for 20-some years. And I think it's a nice thing every year to... Again, like with conferences on Darwin, to just sit down and think about each other and nothing else.
Right. Now, in that sense, that is in fact a general reason to have anniversaries, right?
Yeah.
To refocus people's attention at least once in a while on things that they should probably be thinking from time to time anyway, but they don't.
To put pressure on the husband to actually remember that they're married once a year.
Oh, you think that? Otherwise, you're going to forget it?
Well, isn't that the stereotype? Is the husband doesn't remember the anniversary date until like the day before, and then he scrambles around it.
I have a question for both of you regarding manufacturing holidays or significant dates out of thin air. So there's been some effort in the skeptic and humanist communities to try to find a replacement for Christmas.
Right.
I mean, perihelionox is kind of along those lines.
Right.
And so I guess I'm wondering, given our discussion of Kwanzaa, whether these approaches are doomed to failure because they're new and they, you know, is there anything that we can do to make something stick if it doesn't have its roots in a, you know, a longstanding tradition in our society?
Well, what I notice is less, I don't think any kind of full frontal attack like that would possibly work, especially in this day and age. But what I've seen that is effective, there's an annual, event that started in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and has spread throughout the country called Christmas Revel.
I used to be in that.
Yeah,
well I was
you
in
go.
The Washington Revels.
And what I see with Revels, I mean, my wife is a very big fan, and we went actually to two different ones this year, one in New York and one in Cambridge. What I see with that is this, you know, kind of kindler, gentler way of kind of bringing religion, not completely out of the picture, but sharing space with religion in a celebration of Christmas, with pagan rituals, with solstice, with, you know, in a way that I think is you know, acceptable to Christians in the audience, but getting the job done in terms of making a statement that this is an inclusive holiday. You don't have to be Christian to celebrate it. You have to value community. You have to value you know, the spirit of Christmas, as it were.
Right. No, I tend to agree. I mean, answer to your question, I don't think that any, I agree with Tim that no frontal attack is going to work. It usually doesn't work historically.
Well, I didn't interpret these efforts as attacks. At least that was my take. I interpreted them as providing an alternative.
True. That depends actually on the organization that is in charge of it. Some organizations tend to be more confrontational, as you know, and within the humanist and atheist community than others. And some of them do mean definitely more confrontationally than others. But even when it's not meant confrontationally, it's such an artificial alternative.
Yeah, and the Kwanzaa problem, I think, will always rear its head.
Yeah, that's right.
We just coined a term now?
Exactly. You heard it today on Rationally Speaking. This is the Kwanzaa problem that refers to the attempt to consciously create an artificial holiday, and which is bound to fail. So I agree. Now, it's a matter of personal choice. What do you do? So I don't celebrate Christmas with my daughter, for instance. I do celebrate the solstice, but we do it on the same day. We do it on, you know, pretty much by the same day, in the same general way. Mm-hmm. And I simply want to make the point that I believe in something different. But she celebrates, however, Christmas with her friends and, you know, other relatives. And so it's more along the lines of what Tim was saying, a sort of an inclusive, expanded version of the holiday, rather than, okay, here's what I do and here's what the rest of the world does.
Well, I think it's coming full circle, right? I mean, if the Christians came along and said, we're going to borrow from Saturnalia, and this is just kind of borrowing back.
That's right. The word against Saturnalia, they won the original one, but we might be able to bring it back.
Oh, I wanted to ask you to tell the story of the adaptation of Easter, because I guess, Massimo, you know it, but I didn't. How did that happen?
I don't know.
Oh. Well, the story of the adaptation of Easter, that's also a completely arbitrary. I mean, we don't know, again, from the Gospels when Jesus was actually crucified. There's no date in there. It's a takeover, of course, of the spring, the beginning of the spring season, celebration of the spring season. Popular in a lot of cultures across the world. It was certainly present during the Roman Empire, and so it's yet another example of a almost identical to the situation with Christmas, where the newly established Catholic Church, once that it got the advantage of being able to spread its creed as the official creed of the Roman Empire, which meant that, of course, they had the Roman army at their disposal to do it, then they were able essentially to take over and sort of readapt the local celebration, pre-existing celebrations. Now, that model isn't actually that different from what the Romans themselves used to do. I mean, one of the reasons the Romans were successful for a long period of time in holding such a large empire is because they actually let quite a bit of autonomy to the local populations. As long as they paid the taxes and bowed formally to the power of the Roman Empire, that was about it. You know, they could then do whatever they wanted, and they were not obliged to worship Roman gods. In fact, Romans have a long tradition of essentially finding equivalents between the local gods and their own. So, okay, well, you call it Zeus, we'll call it Jupiter. It's the same thing.
And you could say the same thing about the spread of Islam, actually.
That's right. A similar argument can be made for Islam. Now, for Christianity, it was a little more difficult because, of course, it's supposed to be a monotheistic religion. And so it's hard to make that same argument of, okay, we're going to just absorb your divinities, but we can certainly still absorb your festivities. And that seemed to have worked just as well.
I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense to celebrate Easter in the spring because the symbols surrounding Easter are about rebirth and are about all of the things that spring might otherwise stand for. I mean, the other interesting difference between Easter and Christmas is that Easter more or less coincides with a very, very important Jewish holiday. And not only that, a Jewish holiday that is, pitched in a way that is quite the contrary to Easter.
Right.
So it creates, I mean, my Jewish friends, when I talk to them about Passover in the context of Easter, it that can get a bit of a turn into a bit of a touchy conversation.
Yeah, I can imagine. The part of the issue with Passover, from what I understand, I don't know much about it, so correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand is that actually there is not much, if any, archaeological evidence of any of the events that are supposed to be celebrated. I mean, not even in fact of a large presence of Jewish populations in Egypt.
Judaism is largely a textual religion, so
right.
I know that archaeology is going to be a very important important category for them.
Right, which brings about the question of, you know, well, is it a celebration of what? It's a celebration of an idea, then, not of an actual historical
Well, Easter event. Is entirely a celebration of an idea in that regard.
Right.
If you don't believe in the actual fact of what happened.
So, Tim, we talked about the 1976 anniversary of, you know, the 20th anniversary of the American Revolution. How does that kind of sort of politically charged anniversaries compare on the other side of the pond and, you know, in the British Isles?
Well, as chance had it, 1976 was a year before the Silver Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth in 1977, since she was crowned in 1952. And what's interesting to me about that is, I was in America, it was, despite the fact that it was 4 years after Watergate, it was a breast-beating occasion. There wasn't a whole lot of self-doubt. There was the Robert Altman film here and there, but it was, generally speaking, at least from the point of view of the 12-year-old I was, everyone was on the same page. You know, this was a great country. And I think part of that was because it was a celebration of an idea very much. It was a celebration of American freedom, you could celebrate the holiday without celebrating the people who were in charge of the country.
Right.
The Jubilee for Queen Elizabeth, on the other hand, was very much a celebration of an individual. By definition, it was a celebration of a symbol. And it was going on at a point in time when England was falling apart at the seams, economically, socially, all the rest. So 1977, I mean, what strikes out in my mind about the celebration of Queen Elizabeth's Jubilee that year was the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen, which was a number one hit record, unless you believe the BBC, which banned its being played, and that Rod Stewart was actually number one that year. But and it was a slap in the face of the very idea of monarchy at the very time, timed to coincide with the actual jubilee in June of 1977, that Elizabeth was in theory being carted around the country as the symbol of British greatness. This was 5 years before the Falklands War. It was essentially a point in time when Britain had almost nothing to boast of, and it didn't have Margaret Thatcher lying to them about how much they did still have to boast of. She was 2 years later. Compare that to 2002, the Golden Jubilee. Queen minus Freddie Mercury played at Buckingham Palace. I was in London the day before this all unfolded. I saw the whole thing on TV, as they say, and it was, the country had become much more complacent. It was 12 years into Tony Blair. It was, you know, it was a comp- or you know, 5 years into Tony Blair. It was a completely different climate. And the monarchy, despite some of the trials and tribulations it had gone through in the interim period, was no longer something that people felt terribly inclined to castigate. And that was the case looking back to the early 19th century and the celebrations of monarchs. Queen Victoria, her 25th jubilee went unnoticed. Her 50th was a worldwide, literally a worldwide celebration. All around the British Empire, people celebrated Queen Victoria's Jubilee. And then she lasted 10 more years, and the Diamond Jubilee was even greater. I think it'll be interesting, again, to think of what will happen, assuming Queen Elizabeth survives 3 more years, in her Diamond Jubilee. The longer you stay around, the more people tend to think fondly of you.
But I'm so glad that we managed to bring in the Sex Pistols in Rationally Speaking podcast.
Well, the lessons that I've drawn from this conversation for Perry Heelanox are, it helps to have a great man or great person to associate your anniversary or holiday with. So maybe we need to just crown a king or queen of skepticism or something that we can celebrate.
I nominate Massimo.
Yeah, that's going to be a hard one.
All right. Well, at least hopefully this podcast will bring our number of Google hits for Perry Heelanox above one. So we're out of time for this section of the podcast. Let's wrap it up and move on to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, we pick a suggestion for our listeners that has tickled our rational fancy. This time, we ask our guest, Timothy Halpern, for his suggestions. Tim?
Well, my suggestion was the present I got for Christmas. fittingly enough, by Mike Brown, a book by Mike Brown, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Mike Brown was the astronomer at Caltech who discovered a planet, which he thought was a planet at the time, that was orbiting outside, you know, beyond Pluto, went by the name of Xena for a while, and his discovery of that planet led people to rethink whether Pluto was should be qualified as a planet. This was around 2005 or so, with the ultimate result that both his planet, Xena, and Pluto were expelled from the solar system, not physically, but categorically. And I thought it was especially suitable to mention this book because this last year that we just finished, 2010, would have been the 80th anniversary of the discovery of Pluto. And it's also, this year is the 5th anniversary of the death of Pluto as a planet.
And I am still upset about Pluto being demoted to planetoid or whatever it is that they call it now, because I was very fond of the whole history of the discovery of Pluto in 1930. Oh, well.
We don't have enough holidays about the deaths of planets.
That's true. Like that. That's a good point.
I like that better than the deaths of religious figures.
That's true, actually. It would be, we could have an Easter Pluto. Because who knows, it might rise up.
It might rise up again, that's right.
Become a planet again someday.
Thanks, Tim. I'll put that on my reading list.
Okay, good.
All right, we are now officially out of time. So this concludes another episode of the Rationally Speaking podcast. Before we leave you, I want to encourage everyone to sign up for our conference, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, which the New York City Skeptics and the New England Skeptical Society are putting on in New York City in April, on April 9th and 10th. You can check out the evolving speaker list and topics for the conference at our website, which is nexuscon.org. That's www.nexuscon.org. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.